Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On George R.R. Martin. We got to sit down with him at Comic-Con last week, and we have the whole interview right here for you. For more information about the links and news we talk about on the show, go to our website at www.geekson.com.
Go!
Ladies and gentlemen, here we go!
Hello, my geeklings. Welcome back to Geeks On.
Geeks On!
We are not doing a comic book session.
No comic books. No comic books. No video games.
We are comic'd out this time.
Yes. That's right.
Those of you who have been listening to our show know that we have done Comic-Con recently.
And no Comic-Con.
Discussed
Geeks On.
Yes.
That's right. Yes. Hi, my name is Aaron Hendricks, and I'm a graphic designer and filmmaker here in Los Angeles, and I'm a geek.
Hi, my name is Peter Robinson, and I am a screenwriter and filmmaker here in Los Angeles, and I am a geek.
Hi, my name is Matt King. I'm an actor here in Los Angeles, and I, too, am a geek.
And I am Donald Marshall. I am a writer and a video game professional here in Hollywood, California, and I, too, am a geek.
Woo-hoo!
Yay!
Anybody have a good geek week? Anything going on in the geek world?
Excellent geek week.
I had amazing geek week because Don gave me my 20-sided fuzzy dice for my car.
Yay!
And I installed them.
Did the girlfriend find out?
She cried.
Yes.
Almost cried.
She's going to, like, kill me, isn't she?
She said, honey, no, and then just sort of crawled into it.
Yes. Ball. I saw Eureka, three episodes
Damn.
Of it.
It's
oh,
a great show.
Do you still have it?
I'm saving them for you.
Okay. I want to see that, too. So I think
it's a really interesting show. I really like it a lot.
The premise sounds like a great idea. I'm curious to see it. For those of you not familiar with the show, Eureka consists – it's a storyline is a sheriff finds himself in a small Midwestern town that is entirely populated by super geniuses.
Not quite. It's basically – it's a small Western town that's been invested by the federal government that Einstein actually created in the 40s as a brain trust for super geniuses. So they're there for a specific reason.
So it's a government-sponsored town.
It's a government-sponsored town. And there's
– for research.
Yeah. And there's a research company on the hill, which is sort of – you don't know whether or not it's good or bad or what it's doing. But everybody is invested in the town. And the reason why everybody's the best in the town is because they want to keep all the scientists happy.
Right. Now, you said you've heard mixed reviews about it.
I've heard mixed reviews. Okay.
And I would say that those reviews – definitely have some accuracy to it.
It is the pilot.
And yet, I love it.
Yeah.
It's certainly...
Well, it's still first season. Most sci-fi shows take a season to get on their feet.
It has warts, but to me, it's completely charming and a lot of fun.
It has warts?
It has warts.
Okay.
I saw my super ex-girlfriend.
Oh. Are you okay?
Great concept.
I saw it as well, and I agree.
It wasn't atrocious in its... execution, as far as the filmmaking is fine, the acting is okay. Miscast.
What do you think about Uma Thurman as the crazy girlfriend?
It's fine, but really? The problem is there's just no jokes.
It's the writing that's the problem.
There's no jokes to this movie. There's for a movie whose concept, you know, when you think about the idea of a psycho ex-girlfriend being a superhero, you can probably write 30 jokes in a half hour.
Right.
Just right off that.
Yeah.
There's probably three jokes in this movie.
And they're all in the trailer?
The best jokes are all in the trailer.
The best joke is in the trailer.
The shark
hucking.
Hysterical.
That's the best one, but you see it. Mm-hmm. And then there's like one other one in there. It's like it's really a shame that concept's gone. I mean,
I have to disagree with you, though, in terms of the filmmaking. I thought some of the special effects were really bad.
Yeah, you're right, but it's campy special effects. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, Sky Kids type stuff. It's like, you know you're not going to get, I was going to say Fantastic Four, but that was even worse. You're not going to get X-Men 3 type of, you know, it's campy superhero. So,
right.
You know, I was okay with that. I mean, like the shark looks stupid, but it's fine. He's crashing through a window.
Right.
I mean, what do you want? So, yeah, bummer.
I discovered a new online role-playing game. That I think each of you might enjoy in your own special way. It's free, and it's called Puzzle Pirates.
Were you a net vestite in this one?
No.
For those of you who don't know,
A netvestite, yeah.
What a netvestite is?
A netvestite is someone who always plays the opposite gender character in online role-playing games.
Hi, how you doing? My name's Betty.
So, explain this.
Okay, well, Puzzle Pirates is an MMORPG where you play a little pirate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you, it's like a little Legoland pirate. It doesn't look very realistic, and it doesn't try to be.
Okay.
And you get a little Legoland pirate ship with other people. And there's four people to a ship. I've only just started playing this, so I might get some of the basic principles wrong since I'm brand spanking new to it right now.
Okay.
One person goes to man the bilges. One person does the steering. One person does the carpentry. And the four of you try and maintain the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it works is each of you is doing a mini puzzle game as fast as you can.
That's cool.
Against other people in other ships.
Okay.
So the four of you are trying to kind of coordinate together to keep your ship doing
afloat.
The best it can.
Okay. Ship shape.
Earning money and all that kind of fun stuff. It's very cute. I recommend just checking it out, seeing if
and
it's for
you. And you can chat and everything with these people?
Yep, absolutely. Huh.
I love the cooperative element of that.
The
That's
four
so
of us could sit down and play this puzzle pirate game together.
Well, we should try it out.
How do you talk to folks?
Typing. It's a PC game. I mean, PC games are not yet at the point where it's convenient to have online chat with each other. You have to have an outside program for that.
The other thing, just real quickly, I did read the Halo graphic novel.
Oh.
I did buy that.
What did you think?
I bought it at Comic-Con.
Looked interesting.
I thought it was lame, actually.
Really?
Pretty lame. It's like four short stories. So written by different people, art by completely different people.
The art was sort of indicative. It wasn't really,
The first one, I thought the art was just, the first story, in fact, it was just so confusing. I couldn't tell what was going on in the images. I just couldn't figure out what the hell they were trying to tell me. But the stories are terrible. I mean, there's nothing. It's like watching a slow video game happening. It's like, you know, go pick up, you know, go to the bridge and turn this switch and then go down, meet me here and, you know, blow this door open.
I'm like,
you got to be kidding me. The
graphic novel equivalent of Doom the movie.
Yeah. I mean, they introduce like one thing. Like, if you're a Halo fanatic and you need to know every little bit about Halo, they do reveal like one or two little things that I didn't know about the world. And since
how about the Master Chief, who's the big
mystery? That's the other thing. When one of the there is no Master Chief story. There is one where Master Chief type, you know, goes through training where they're working out the suit.
Right.
And, you know, they take off the helmet and it's a woman. And that's supposed to be this big reveal, like who really cares. But again, we have the same problem that, you know, I love Halo.
Didn't we already do that in Metroid and we kind of got over it?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah. So suddenly they're Metroid. But the problem with the path that Bungie is going down, which is emphasized here, is that the mystery is slowly fading away. Aliens are talking like humans. They have societies just like humans. There's nothing alien about them at all. That was the lame thing about Halo 2, is that you played the Arbiter, and he talked like some, you know, white conservative white guy.
Ensign Jones.
Yeah.
As Arbiter.
And they have, you know, an internal struggle just like some small country. There's nothing alien about them. And they have the same problem here. You follow the aliens in one of these stories, and they just talk talk like regular humans. They unmask these Master Chiefs. I don't want to see what's inside the mask. It's just the mystery's gone. I'm worried about the movie now. That's all I'm going to say.
All right.
And let me take this opportunity to apologize to all of our listeners who got their hopes up when we promised no comic book talk this episode.
I didn't. There's no real spoilers in that, but anyway.
Yeah.
Well, shall we do a little geek news?
Yes.
Let's hit it.
Geek Cue the music. News.
Okay.
Excellent.
Why don't you start us off, Matt?
Why don't I hit it? All right. So, there's a Google geek who unearthed a military secret. All right. Now, people have been on Google Earth like 24/7. It's created all these societies now of people who are trying to up one another with their finds on Google Earth. So,
and they find some crazy stuff.
Yeah, they found hover cars in Australia. They found curious concentric circles in Malta. Strange things in the Sea of Japan.
Craters.
They found, you know, a guy found a Roman villa in his backyard.
I love that one.
Old bombers flying in the, like, the World War II bombers that happened to be flying, that, like, some guy owned one and was flying it, and they actually captured it in midair.
Yep. So, craziness.
Totally weird stuff.
So, last month, while scrutinizing landscapes in Japan, German Googler Ken Grok discovered what appeared to be a terrain model on a Chinese military base. Terrain model, all right? It was not just any terrain. Ken Grok unexpectedly found an exact scale replica of China's disputed border region with India.
Oh,
shit.
Exactly.
They recreated the landscape so they could battle.
Yeah, 1 to 500 size, right? A piece of land that led the countries into war in 1962 and which remains, to this day, in dispute.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
So why would they make it at a small scale?
Well, it's 1 to 500. I mean, that's exactly. So,
could you imagine building your border inland?
Basically, it's really, really heavily mountainous region, and they can't go to the mountains or say, you know, this is mountainous terrain, so they brought the mountains to them. That's how they're explaining it right now. It's one of the most interesting things anyone's ever observed anywhere, says Tim Brown, a specialist in satellite imagery and a senior fellow at globalsecurity.org. It's obviously of the disputed border. It's oriented exactly. Now, here's what they're saying. China has claimed this as a tank training facility, and they're saying they're putting tanks in their drivers through their paces.
But that's what I'm wondering. Like, if it's a wrong scale.
Exactly. It's 1 to 500 scale. There is no way that you could put a tank through this. This is specifically for humans to walk over the map and figure out, like, exactly how they would put troops in, how...
Oh, so it's a big map. It's a big battle map,
it's
not a
gigantic
training.
It's a sim map.
It's a sim map. Right.
Why don't they just build one of those, like, you know, super agent bad guy things that come up from the floor and they can push little plastic tanks around?
Because they don't exist.
Yes. Oh. They're saying, basically, don't worry about it. China's most of the time deals with borders disputes diplomatically.
Did I misunderstand? But I thought you said they discovered this in Japan, not in China.
No, China.
Oh, in China. Okay.
Yeah, China. In China. Yeah.
Is there, oh, man. If they find, like, a United States 500th scale.
The Rockies one would find,
like, oh,
500 scale.
Would
be like, oh, man.
With little plastic tanks pushing around. Holy hell.
Exactly.
Oh, dear.
But they said they also have... full-scale airfields constructed exactly like the Taiwanese airfields.
Do they have a link to that on Google Map?
I mean, I believe they have a link. I got it off of ABC News, but I believe they have a link to it and where it happened. So.
I can't help the feeling that, like, some of our greatest mysteries of our ages will be unlocked by some schmo using
somebody's going to be like,
the real secret of the Bermuda Triangle will be uncovered.
Is that Atlantis?
This is what's so... amazing about the internet is that it allows people from all over the place to leverage their abilities. I mean, Wikipedia is, you know, while I won't say it's always accurate, it's phenomenal the knowledge you can find on there.
Right. And it allows people to leverage their damn free time.
Did you hear this thing that Stephen Colbert did this week with Wikipedia?
Yeah.
And it crashed Wikipedia for a night. Yeah.
But also, very quickly.
For those of you not familiar, he tried to change one of the listings of Wikipedia to say that the African elephant's population has tripled in the past week.
Right.
Which it has not, but just to prove a point.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, it was changed immediately back by Wikipedia listeners. So.
But thousands and thousands of times. It went back and forth and back and forth. So now it's locked. You have to be, you know, a registered member and all that to even make a change on that website.
You know, there was some guy at Wikipedia just watching the Stephen Colbert show going like, oh, no.
I hate you.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you son of a...
Yeah.
I'd say the word, but Flash Gordon would come beat us up.
Yeah. Oh, yes, he would.
Don!
Hi!
News!
I'm Don. Well, I just wanted to take a moment to discuss a movie that Peter and I both saw this week, Lady in the Water.
All right. Mm.
Now, I'm curious, because we haven't talked about this. What did you think?
We have not.
M. Night Shyamalan.
Yes!
Damn it.
So, anyway, M. Night Shyamalan's Lady in the Water. I have said over the past couple weeks that I would go see it. I said this was the last chance for M. Night, who has let me down too many times in the past.
What was the twist?
Unfortunately, the twist, I saw the twist.
Don't tell me the twist.
I'm not blowing it.
There was no twist. What are you talking about?
There was a twist. There absolutely was a twist.
Wow. Okay, you'll have to talk later.
Okay, but I can see already that Peter didn't get the twist.
It was so obvious that the twist
didn't realize it was a twist.
Okay.
I actually was quite happy with the movie. I really enjoyed myself. I went into – but I'm not sure if it's because I went into it with low expectations. Hmm. But I found that there was a nice – very sweet tone to the movie all the way through.
You know, it was a children's book, right?
Yeah, it was, and it carried that way.
Okay,
the movie had that feeling to it. So once I kind of gave myself into it's a fairy tale,
right?
And the opening, I thought that they have an animated introduction to the movie that I recommend you not miss, just because it set the tone for the movie,
right?
And with all of that together, I had a very nice time. I enjoyed all of the performances. There were a couple. Standard M. Night strange, weird choices. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a character, not blowing any plot points, but there's a character who's worked out half his body. So
yeah,
half his
body is enormously
muscled, and the other is completely normal.
Right.
And I never quite figured out what that was supposed to mean.
That's kind of like the Baron von Munchausen thing. With the guy who has the one leg, which is super fast.
Yes, exactly. I have a feeling that it's some sort of symbol for something that just went over my head. I just must have missed something.
Masturbation?
Let me throw in my take on this.
Peter doesn't look as happy about the movie.
Well, I don't think this is a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, I have to say, I think it's actually very clumsily put together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It uses a lot of techniques that are just not good writing techniques.
Mm-hmm. Gene Siskel will be played by the part of Peter.
Now, on the other side of things, I do think it has an incredibly sweet tone, and that is its redeeming feature for me.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, you cannot help but appreciate the tone and the intent and those feelings that he's engendered into it, but it's a weird movie. It's got a lot of weird things, incredibly creative and fun, but they don't congeal well because
I know what you're talking about as far as structure goes. It was an awkward structure, but I think it was I'm assuming that's because it was playing directly off of a book. I don't know. I haven't read the book.
Even in terms of how it tells you information in the clumsiest possible way it could tell you information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's an interesting film. You know, I would not tell people not to see it. I think it's worth seeing and it's worth discussing.
One of the things I thought was interesting though about the way the movie is filmed is it's telling this very kind of beautiful, sweet fairy tale story that's full of magic against a backdrop that is completely devoid of it.
Yeah.
I mean, a big monster running around scaring the hell out of it.
There is a monster. And I actually thought the monster was quite well done.
It was very interesting.
I enjoyed the monster in the movie.
Right.
Hmm.
That's hard to do these days.
Completely unintelligible why the monster actually exists and is doing what it's doing. Yes, there is a monster.
it's like... Here was my
as
problem
well as
with the structure.
The creatures, you know,
this
yeah.
is great.
My problem with the structure of the movie was he sets a rule, and then he comes up with an idea where, like, oh, it'd be kind of cool if this happened. But I've already established that can't happen. Oh, well, screw it. We'll have it happen, and then I'll explain why it happened later. Right?
So, yeah, that sounds bizarre.
Yeah, it's like you set up a premise only to break it, so you've betrayed the audience's
expectations,
but not in a good way.
Mm.
But it's in very small ways, so you're able to forgive, and the explanation comes fairly quickly usually. So,
okay. Sounds like we need to see it in order
awkward,
to get
but
this.
I give it a thumbs up.
Okay. Peter's thumbs.
I give it a
thumb sideways.
Yes. And Aaron,
angling a little down.
When Aaron and I come back and we'll see it, and I'll be glowing, and
Aaron will give it a
crap for whatever. The crap. Russian boat song playing across the speakers.
Hit it, Aero.
I would like for us to discuss the demise of E3.
It's not the demise of E3. The restructuring of E3.
As most video game geeks already know, this week was announced that E3 video game conference is not going away, but it is radically changing.
The original announcement did say canceled.
Well,
the original announcement did say canceled.
So next year was canceled.
Yes.
Okay. It hasn't been canceled.
Why?
The story broke as a rumor, and then there was an official announcement saying that there's gonna be some big changes. Essentially, this is what's happened from what people have gathered. And we've been kind of, we knew about this for a while. Most of the major developers and publishers out there believe that E3 essentially was a waste of time and money for them, that they weren't getting the return they hoped for with the amount of money and work put into it. I mean, if you've been to E3 and you've seen Microsoft booths, Sony booths, EA's booths, Activision's booths, you can see that a minimum of $10 million on the booth alone is being spent.
How much would you say overall is spent on E3 in a given year?
I wouldn't begin to guess.
I couldn't.
Over, what you're seeing is just the tip of the iceberg.
Over $100 million?
But, well,
oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
oh
yeah.
My God. Over, in a sneeze.
Over $500 million.
But here's the other problem. Wow. This is the money it's hard to calculate, is they all have to put teams either together or derail teams to put together game videos for months and months that will be demoed at E3.
Okay.
And that's also a huge cost to them.
So now they're devaluing.
It can also affect game development.
Are they devaluing the value of press their games being seen?
Here's the other thing is most press. Now, here's where I'm starting to stray from this. Most press say that they can't get their work done at the current E3.
Because
they're
it's too loud,
they're fighting people who shouldn't be there. They're fighting booth babes. They're fighting noise. They're fighting
those annoying podcasters.
They're fighting booths that are there to impress, the casual, stroller at E3 who shouldn't be there, and they can't get in and get interviews and get the real information. But
I feel like they might be shooting themselves in the foot.
I don't think it's the media that's having the problem, and I actually agree with them on another level that you haven't brought up yet. I believe another one of the reasons is the larger publishers believe they're carrying E3, and that a lot of these other booths are just leeching off their press.
Right.
Okay.
So, which is true.
Yeah.
I think that's the reason why it's changing. Yeah. I think probably Microsoft, Sony, and EA or whatever big people out there said, we're out. In fact, it only takes one of those guys to drop out for E3 to be canceled. I mean, what are you going to do if Microsoft doesn't show up?
By the way, I did very quick research. E3 costs $100 million about a year.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
E3 itself, but not the preparation.
Yeah,
for
not
it,
the
not
again the developers. Yeah. So so what they've just said that they the people at E3, I can't remember the organization behind it. Yes, not the ESRB.
Which the organization behind E3 itself?
Yeah.
All right. Whatever.
Anyway,
that
so what they said they want to keep the excitement that's currently going on about E3, but make it so. Yeah. Right.
I bet they do.
So, but have it that be smaller, invite only, where literally the publishers and developers invite people to come to a room at a hotel and get demoed what they want to show. Period. And that is it.
That's good for the gaming industry. I think it's bad for buzz. I think it's bad for the consumer.
I don't think it's good. And I agree, Matt. I think what they're failing to understand is that for 1 week it was video game week.
Yep.
G4 covered it. It was a giant party. But the reason why GameSpot and IGN have entire weeks filled because it's a party that most people can't get into. It's that one club that you wait in line for
the whole
and
year.
You can't get into because it's so awesome in there.
Yep.
And yes, you're right. They're trying to outdo each other. That's another thing. I think developers are sick and tired of competing with each other. They don't want that competition. And
big dumb.
But I'm sad that we're not going to have that feeling anymore. We're not going to have E3 is not going to be exciting.
Well, we
I'm
won't
sorry.
Have
but
it for one
that...
year, and then we'll see how it affects their profits.
That's true.
And then we might have it back.
But my question is, I don't know how much that affects their profits. I don't know if E3 itself increases video game sales during that time period.
No, here's how it affects it.
You know?
The reason why video... Because right now we're in an era where video games are the biggest media...
Out
there. And it hasn't been that all forever.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And part of that reason is because our culture is excited about it.
And so, our culture are geeks, and our culture speak through word of mouth, and our culture are basically web savvy. So it's not necessarily about press or junkets or what their $10 million event is. But it's who's talking about what.
Right, exactly. Right. And, you know,
E3 does not necessarily spark that sort of thing. Spore,
no, but it means
let's take Spore as an example. People were talking about Spore before E3, and they're talking about the same after E3.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, in general, we're not going to have a video game week where we're all excited about video games, not a video game. That we're all going, this week is like, we don't have this before movies. We don't have,
Oscars.
I don't know that.
Yeah, but the
my wondering is, I have no proof or facts or figures to put this on, but here's what I'm wondering.
Mm-hmm.
If during that 1 week, people are so excited about what will be coming out in 1 month or 2 months or 3 months that they stop buying this month.
They do.
That's what I'm wondering.
Everyone knows that nothing comes out for 2 months after E3.
Right. So basically you're saying they need to sink all of this money into E3 to plug projects that will come out in 3 months in order to scuttle their shit.
No, what I'm saying is stop thinking about the one game you're trying to sell next year and think about keeping video games as an exciting cultural event.
Yeah, exactly.
The whole world of video games, not one video game. Stop worrying about Spore and worry about the fact that video games is overtaking primetime television, listening to music, downloading shit for your iPod, that people want to be playing video games, and they should make that important and exciting. And
exactly.
That's what you're going to lose.
Exactly.
So I get what you're saying. I do understand. But trying to come at it from a corporate perspective, I have to blow $5 million to fuel a concept,
yeah,
as opposed to what my else? Own product?
Just like politics.
Hey, guess what happened?
They're not in politics.
No.
To make a profit,
Don.
You know
what happens if we have another '80s crash of video games like it used to be because everyone's kind of sick and tired of it, or we find out, or no one's really interested in it.
Right.
EA is going to have a really hard time if we have another ET extraterrestrial, Atari 2600 crash, and no one wants to buy video games anymore.
I don't know. I'm not really buying some of these arguments.
I'm just saying that it is very rare that a media, like television, film, music has an event this big that the entire world gets so excited for. And when you start pulling this away, who knows? Maybe next year they'll pull something else away.
Yeah. What happens if we pull away the Oscars and we go, the Oscars don't get to happen? How much of that movie buzz then gets drawn away?
If
they wanted to do, a video game awards,
mm-hmm.
They do.
Yeah,
they do, and they have that.
But it's nonsense, and nobody watches it.
Nobody
cares. E3 is what they watch.
Well, listen, the people who know better than we know what's worth, what type of publicity they get, how much it's worth to them, what energy it creates, they're the ones who said, it's not really doing that much for us.
I think Microsoft basically said, how much money are we spending in our advertising budget for the rest of the year, and how much are we allowing other video games to ride on our coattails when we're the ones spending the money here on advertisement? We don't need E3. And as soon as they pulled out, Sony went, well, why do we need to be there too? Because if Microsoft is going to be able to pull out their advertising budget and send it towards video games.
Did Microsoft do that?
Then we
know. He's just using them as an example.
I'm supposing. Okay. I'm saying, right? I mean, this is basically a logical scenario.
As a side note, I doubt Microsoft would do that.
Right. But okay, so then Sony says,
or
we don't
EA,
need to do this.
Any one of those big, giant.
We can now take our advertising money that we use for E3 and we can take that $20 million, that $10 million,
okay,
that whatever,
two
and
things.
Put it into
to,
a video game.
To disagree with Peter, I wish I could say that I admired many of the great marketing minds that I have met in the video game industry. There have been some great ones. I will not say that there are not, but I have gotten a lot of impression of a lot of the marketing people I've met are not video game players and don't especially like video game players. Which on that side, I'm with these guys. I have a feeling they have no concept of what they're doing. On the other side of things, I don't entirely agree that one person is going to bring down a house of cards that is E3. If EA pulls out of E3, my bet would actually be other people would step in and just say, one of the big competitors just got out of the way. Let's completely take over this space.
I think they were all looking for an excuse. I think
it's
all
possible.
The big guys were all looking for an excuse to, and but somebody, my, maybe they all called
is,
each other.
Yeah, my bet is the big guys just decided, we don't want to pay for you little guys anymore.
And I think that's another shame because there's a lot of those little guys down below that needed to be looked at.
And also, a lot of those little guys are developing interesting games.
Yeah, Guitar
exactly
Hero
like
too.
Guitar Hero.
Let's compare this to Comic-Con, okay? Comic-Con is a thing that's specifically put out for fans, mm-hmm. okay? People go down there. They pay for it with their own money.
Right.
You know, and when they're coming in there, they're not doing these elaborate booths.
Same thing with E3.
No. Not the same thing for E3.
Yeah, E3, they pay for their own stuff.
Yeah.
Who do you think's paying for E3?
When you go to E3, it's not fans that are showing up. It's $500 to get in.
E3 is correct. They pay an admission fee. A fan pays an admission fee to get into Comic-Con.
Right. You mean the attendees, yeah. not the...
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
I mean,
vast majority of E3 people are comped in.
Yeah. I mean, it's just they're these two entirely different things, and I just don't think that economically they're working on the same
level. Now Comic-Con, suddenly this last week was even on MTV where they're talking about all the cool things
that are
going on. Well,
hold on. It's very difficult to compare the two because Comic-Con is a commercial endeavor. These mm-hmm. people are there to sell things to a public. E3 is not. E3 is not there to sell video games to you. They are there to sell video games to maybe 14 or 15 people in attendance.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And you know what?
They don't care about the rest
of
you.
And here's my point. If they're trying to sell it to 14 or 15 people mm-hmm. for $10 million for a booth, they can just pay, you know, what is it, $1,000 to fly them out.
Exactly.
And that makes a lot more sense because on top of that, they've got that person's direct attention on only their project.
Exactly.
Right? Why
you're the buyer. Oh, you're a buyer for Best Buy. Would you like to come to Los Angeles, all expenses paid, stay in a 5-star hotel, first class accommodations, eat on our tab the entire time, and maybe see a few of our video games while you're out here? We could introduce you to some porn stars. You know, just...
Yeah, but, you
not
know,
that I'm saying
to,
anyone
to,
would do that.
To kind of wrap this up, you know, one of the reasons, I think one of the reasons why they put up the big booths and all that is because the buyers are waiting to hear the buzz. They're not walking in getting a demo of some game that a guy's never going to play. He's hoping his 13-year-old will like it. He doesn't know. He's going to look at all these big booths and go, wow, everyone's over there talking about Nintendo.
Yeah.
No, but what's happening is...
But you're not going to get that anymore.
They're all coming into one place, and they're all competing for this time in this one limited thing, and they're artificially escalating what they've got to throw all this money up here to get everybody's attention. And it's like, why? Why? Well, why do we have to fight over like getting this guy's 15 minutes over here during this week?
I don't agree that it's any corporation's responsibility to keep a cultural trend going. I disagree.
If you want money from it, you want to maintain it.
If you want money from it and you want to maintain it, continue producing good products that keep me
interested.
Trust
me, if the television people could all get together and have a giant event that got people as riled up for 1 week about television, their asses would be there in a heartbeat.
Yeah, or even more
Are you kidding me?
Are you kidding me?
No, wait.
Where was Television Week? Every channel's covering Television Week.
There is a Television Week. It's called Sweeps Week.
But why would they want to have every
news channel cover Sweeps Week?
Nobody knows what Sweeps Week is except for people in Hollywood.
Look.
What?
All they know is that Nip Tuck showed more ass this week.
Right. That has nothing to do with whether or not the entire week is about video games or the entire week is not about television. Oh my God, this just, you know, came out. They're nowhere near. How about the music industry?
When Survivor comes to an end, there's no media coverage.
It's not about...
There isn't weeks of media frenzy around the
ending
of the
show. But that's one specific show that's the biggest show on television. That's like saying when Halo comes out, there's a lot
of
media coverage.
Every season finale has media coverage of some sort.
Not the same.
Look, my point is, okay, that... If they had the same type of thing with TV, they would quickly realize, you know what? We're trying to build up all this attention, and they're doing it not to get people excited about television. No, they're doing it to get people excited about Survivor.
They
realize, gee, we're doing all this to get people excited about Survivor, and Survivor got one line because there were 96 other people here that had to be covered too.
Right, hang on. The music industry right now, right? The music industry would die for publicity like what E3 has, right? Because they're tanking. They're tanking because what they're doing is saying, hey, we'll fly you out, we'll get a couple of porn stars, and we'll get you in a room, and we'll sell you our 14 CDs and make sure it's on your shelves. But there's nobody giving a crap about it, and there's nobody talking about it. People are getting their music in other ways, and they're not basically saying, this is Music Week. Let's spend a time talking about the new artists and everything.
So wait. Your argument is that the music industry is tanking because they don't have enough publicity?
No. All right. For the guy who... Because I brought this... this up. I'm going to have to end this. This is not the topic of this episode. We'll have to make it a topic some other time. We need to move on.
We'll be good.
All righty.
All right. My news stories. There's a new type of body armor that they have that is actually a liquid body armor. They've invented something that is garments constructed from layers of tough fibers and fluid polymers.
So if you're in a swimming pool, you're protected from a bullet. Great.
No.
Like, how do you keep
it
on your body?
No. Actually, what they do is they have it in between.
Think a gel.
It's like a gel. Well, the original thought was that it's something that you put on your body like peanut butter. Okay.
Oh,
weird idea. Now, the way this works is when the fluid's hit by a hard thing, it solidifies.
Yeah.
Okay. And then it instantly relaxes and it distributes the force.
That's cool.
Did you ever do that science experiment in school with cornstarch and water?
No.
You put a lot of cornstarch. It's the same principle that you're talking about right now. You put a lot of cornstarch in water.
Honest. Okay, go ahead.
And then if you kind of lower your finger into it, it's like water. But if you jam it with your finger, the surface tension gets hard and resists your finger entering.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool.
So anyway, what they're doing actually in this case is they've got like sort of body armor, and they're putting layers of gel in between strips of body armor.
So wait, the faster you go at this, the more it resists?
The more, you hit it
so
really hard.
So we basically invented the shields from Dune?
That's what I was going to say. They've invented the shields from Dune. That's exactly where I was headed with this one. That was my connection. So, and they're actually initially targeting the people who are making this guards at prison centers because this will actually resist knives as well, which I guess regular body armor doesn't.
No.
So.
Does not.
Very interesting.
Kevlar, you can definitely shiv through.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
All right. New on
sci-fi. You can also probably put in the joints because you can bend your arm and you can.
Well, Aaron, and where's the love, man?
The other advantage is it's actually a lot lighter and, a lot lighter and more mobile.
Huh. Very cool. All right. Sorry, Matt.
New on sci-fi, sci-fi this week. I'm going to put a link to, there's a new sci-fi channel show that they're trying to get going.
Yeah.
But it's literally about going to the website and clicking on it and checking out the pilot. It's a new steampunk show in an alternate reality.
And make me the steampunk.
Right. It's called The Amazing Screw-On Head.
Oh, yes. I've heard about this.
And what literally it is...
That's a terrible name.
It's invented by the guy who did Hellboy. And it's in that artistic style. It's beautiful. It's an alternate history in which Abe Lincoln has his number one super spy, who is the Amazing Screw-On Head. It's sort of Lovecraftian horror meets a steampunk adventure. It's really, really
neat. So you can go there now?
You can go there now. You can go to the website link that I'll leave. Nice. And you can check out the website. You can check out the pilot episode.
For our new listeners, we put links to all of the news articles that we discuss on geekson.com.
Yeah. Right now, the first thing is when Archfiend Emperor Zombie steals an artifact that will enable him to threaten all life on Earth, the task of stopping him is assigned to Screw-On Head. Fortunately, Screw-On Head is not alone in this perilous quest. He is aided by his multi-talented manservant, Mr. Groin, and by his talking canine cohort, Mr. Dog.
Now, you do realize how awful this sounds.
Yes.
It's not,
wonderful.
Yeah. Okay. When you're describing the genre, it sounds really good, and then you go into the details
and it's being voiced. It's also voiced by Paul Giamatti and David Hyde Pierce.
All right. Well, we'll have to take a look at it.
I love the talent.
Yep.
All right. One quick little news story. For those of you who are wondering, what the hell happened to the WB cartoons? Like, where they all went?
They all became anime and suck-ass.
Yeah, like, Justice League went away. I miss Justice League. It was a good show. The DCU and Warner's Animation have started producing direct-to-DVD comic movies. The first three will be New Frontier, Justice League, Teen Titans, and Superman Doomsday.
Interesting.
All of these are adaptations of the actual comic books. Mm-hmm. And graphic novels, so it's not the anime Teen Titans. It's the Teen Titans.
Oh, good.
And it's being written by Marv Wolfman, who wrote the original Golden Age of the Teen Titans comic.
I'm interested in seeing this.
I sense Straczynski yelling.
What's Superman Doomed or whatever?
Doomsday.
Doomsday. What's
Doomsday?
That about?
Are you familiar with the storyline?
Uh-uh.
Doomsday was the very big storyline they came up with in the mid-90s, where Doomsday came to Earth. He was this big character they made just for that storyline and killed Superman.
Oh, that's his death.
That's the death of Superman.
Okay.
So it's apparently a condensed version of that whole episode. Probably 90 minutes,
I'm guessing. Split into like five different Supermans after that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it looks like DC is joining the fight against the Marvel Comics versions of the Avengers, which is now going into its second episode of the Avengers movie right now.
Which I heard was good, right?
I saw the first one. It was okay. The first Avengers movie I watched was like, it was better than the old Marvel cartoons, but not quite up to what I would expect from an actual full-scale movie.
Hmm. Okay.
But they're still getting their feet wet.
Yeah.
Any last things?
Two quick things. There are things that could obviously be much bigger topics, but...
But we won't argue about them tonight.
We'll argue about them another time. for those of you who don't know, you know, not too long ago, Kansas's Board of Education adopted science standards that basically really challenged evolution. They really pushed for intelligent design. Well, this week they had the elections for the Board of Education, and it's changed and gone back towards the moderates. And it's clear that they're going to be shifting back towards evolution. So, and they're going to be pushing more towards sex ed in the schools.
Yay.
So this is very interesting. You know,
they removed sex ed too.
Yeah, the guys had.
Isn't that hilarious that that's considered moderate?
No. Well, that they're bringing back sex
oh my
ed.
God.
I know, but
it depends what exactly sex ed covers.
That
it's
is
it's whether it's moderate
broad,
or not.
Like, this is Mrs. Jonas. We're going to be showing you several of the Kama Sutra positions. Yes.
That's not moderate.
Yes, exactly. So then the other one is I found these two interesting articles about people who were arrested for either taking pictures or videotaping the police when they were doing things. Now, one was this guy is coming out. He basically is in Philadelphia, and this guy talks about how one night he heard a commotion. He walked out his back door to see police arresting a drug dealer, and he popped out his cell phone and took a picture. And the cops walked up to him, grabbed him, and pulled him out of his yard, threw him on the back of a car, handcuffed him, and arrested him, and said that there was a new law saying that you can't take pictures of police.
Wow.
Well,
what?
Now
there's a lawsuit right ready to burst.
Not if it's an actual law.
And
there's no law like that.
There's no way.
I can't imagine, but
yet. Well, actually, the ACLU said that they do not think there could be a law like this. They said that's ridiculous. But yeah, they threatened to charge me with conspiracy, impeding an investigation, obstruction of an investigation. They said, you were impeding this investigation. I asked, by doing what? The officer said, by taking a picture of the police officers with a camera phone. Thought that was pretty wild.
Hmm.
Now, the other story is really interesting. There was a man whose kid was being investigated for a crime. And the police officers showed up, and they said he lived in a bad area, and he had because he lived in not a great area, he had surveillance cameras that recorded video and recorded sound. And he the cop showed up, and he said, you know, I'm going to have to ask you to leave if you don't have a warrant. My son's not here. And the cop put his foot in the door, blocking the door from closing, and threatened him, made sort of threatening types of things. So he and his wife went and got there, and he even told him. He said, you know, there's a video camera right there. Smile for it, you know. And so he goes and he gets his video camera, and he goes down and asks to talk to someone about what's happened, and they arrest him. They arrest him saying that two felony counts of violating state eavesdropping and wiretap laws by using an electronic device to record Karras without the detective's consent.
Great. So Bush can listen to my phone conversations, but I can't record what's going on my front doorstep?
On my own property. It's
so he's actually...
Even though he had signs up saying this area is being recorded.
Yeah.
So now...
But you can... That's weird because you can totally record... You can take pictures of anybody.
Well...
That's...
Yeah, that
you know, unless you have a...
This is what most people have been saying, is that this is completely bogus, but
yeah,
I just...
Yeah, that will go up to... If that will go
I'm sure
up to a higher court.
They'll win.
I mean, if you go to YouTube...
To see if this is only happening in one specific area, or...
These
Kansas.
Are just isolated...
Kansas.
Yeah.
All right.
This is in Nashua, where this one happened.
Oh, okay.
You know,
Nashua
but they're isolated.
Nashville?
Nashua.
Nashua,
yeah.
New Hampshire?
I have no idea where Nashua is, so... And it doesn't say.
That's
there.
That's your part?
It's there.
So...
Sure. All right, finally.
By the way, go to YouTube. There's all sorts of guys
stuff
being arrested with people videotaping, like,
cops.
People screaming out at George Bush at rallies and stuff, where they arrest them, and they've got them all on videotape.
Jack.
It's pretty interesting.
All right, finally. Dan Kaminsky, who's a DNS hacker, has devised a test for checking to see if your internet connection is net neutral. That is whether your connection's being filtered, throttled, slowed down, or monkeyed with secretly by your ISP. Mm-hmm. Kaminsky calls his technique TCP-based active probing for faults. And the software he's developing will be similar to the Traceroute Internet utility. Unlike Traceroute, Kaminsky's software will be able to make traffic appear as if it's coming from a particular carrier or is being used for a certain type of application like VoIP.
Uh-huh.
It will also be able to identify where the traffic's being dropped and could ultimately be used to finger service providers that are treating some network traffic as second class.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I need that.
Exactly.
Because so, my connection has been bad for the past
couple
weeks.
Right, and I'm paying for a damn good connection.
Yeah, me too.
So I want to know what the heck's going
on. All right. You hear that, Comcast? I'm coming for you, people.
Cool. That is very cool.
Is that for Geek News?
That's it for Geek News.
Because we have a great topic tonight.
We have a fantastic topic.
What is that topic?
Well, for those of you who haven't listened to the opening of our Geeks On episode, this is our very special George R.R. Martin interview.
For those of us who don't, well, not us, I know, but for those of you out there who do not know who George R.R. Martin is, why don't we explain who he is?
He's a fantastic writer. Who most famous right now for the Song of Ice and Fire series.
Also known, unfortunately, as the Game of Thrones, series.
Because Game it started with Game of Thrones. Yeah. Also Tough Voyaging, also the Wild Card series, which he edited and then wrote for, with Melinda M. Snodgrass, among other people.
And these are, by the way, you know, the Game of Wild Cards series is a superhero universe that you have never seen before. It's amazing. And what he did was he brought just fantastic writers, Zelazny, all sorts of people together, and they wrote these short stories in this amazing
alternate history.
Alternate history, and there's like 20 books, and they are phenomenal.
Wow. Yeah, every one of them.
Excellent. But he's also written for television.
Yeah, he's the writer for Beauty and the Beast, the original series on TV. He also wrote for the original.
I think he did like Outer Limits.
Yeah,
or
he did
like
Outer
that.
Limits. He did Twilight Zone.
He's a 10-year veteran version of Hollywood. I think he said. Which left its scars, but helped shape the writer he is today.
Yes.
And we were lucky enough to score an interview with him. And must say, he was a lovely, lovely person.
Incredibly forthcoming.
So nice. But you have to understand when you listen to this episode, there were three of us there, and all three of us are writers, and all three of us... Okay, we're a little bit inspired by the man.
We gushed on his shoes.
We gushed all over him. It was very embarrassing. I never shut up. I walked into the room and I was just like, I can't say anything. Hi. Mm-hmm. You write good.
And to give you a sense of, I mean, the quality of his writing, I mean, he's one of the top three writers in the sci-fi fantasy field. You know, Tolkien's one of those people that everybody knows, and I put him up there. Also, Robert Jordan is someone that people really track and have huge enthusiasm for. He's right up there with these guys, and I think actually probably, you know, better.
Blows them all away in your opinion.
My personal opinion
mine
is
as well.
Phenomenal. So
I think he's a damn good heir to Tolkien.
So last year we got Orson Scott Card. This year, Mr. Martin.
Woohoo!
We're doing well on the interviews here.
Martin.
And for those of you who are interested, go back into our archives, and we still have the Orson Scott Card interview available on our archives.
Excellent.
All right, so to move things along, here is our interview
with George R.R. Martin. Here we are. It is Matt and Pete with Geeks On, and we have with us George R.R. Martin.
Yes, George R.R. Martin. We are very excited about this.
The creator of the Song of Ice and Fire series, Game of Thrones, Clash of Kings.
Wild Cards. Fever Dream.
Man. What else? The Outer Limits, Twilight Zone.
Beauty and the Beast was...
Beauty and the Beast, man. I mean, just that alone was something. Actually, I had a question specifically about Beauty and the Beast. I noticed that you have this thing in Game of Thrones, in the Song of Ice and Fire, where basically you have hidden worlds within worlds. The reveal of magic slowly coming in as slowly seeping into the world. And I noticed that theme as well in Beauty and the Beast. Is that something that sort of is a theme that's important to you, or is it something that just happened to happen?
Well, my version of Beauty and the Beast really didn't have much magic in it. I mean, there was the hidden world below the sewers of New York. But we never really explained Vincent's origins, and he was the only overtly fantastic element in that show. But I do think that magic needs to be handled very carefully in fantasy. I gave a lot of thought to it when I did A Song of Ice and Fire, when I began it, going back to look at Tolkien, because I think magic is something, you know, you need it for fantasy. I think without some magical element, it's not really fantasy. But on the other hand, it's very easy to use too much of it. And if you use too much of it, it spoils the whole stew. It's like salt, you know. A little salt makes it taste good. Too much salt, and all you can taste is the salt. And that's the case with magic.
Now, with the magic within these pieces, it's sort of come to a crescendo so far. Now, with your last book, it was sort of a half a book. I was noticing that with this half a book, you sort of stayed away from Daenerys and stuff like that, who I sort of treat as the overtly magical characters within the story.
Well, she has the dragons, and the dragons are probably the single largest magical element in the story, and also, of course, a linchpin of the magic in the entire world. The fact that the dragons are back is one of the things that's, you know, are the dragons back because magic is increasing, or is magic increasing because the dragons are back? I leave that question open for the characters and the readers both to ponder. But Daenerys not being in the book was simply a case of the length of the book. The book was not done yet, and it was getting monstrously long, and it was pretty clear that I either had to make very, very deep cuts in the book, which I didn't want to do. I felt it would lessen the book, or I had to divide it in two in some manner. One of those would have been to simply divide it right in the middle, just to take the first 1,300 pages or so and say, okay.
1,300 pages?
Yeah, the first 1,300 pages, yes. Just to take that bit and say, here's the book, and then the rest will be in the next book. And, you know, that would have had all the characters, but their stories all would have sort of been interrupted halfway through.
If you're writing 1,300 pages, how many pages do you write a day?
Not enough. That's why the book was 5 years late. I need to write more pages a day, obviously. So instead, we divided the book by character. And Dany, since she's on another continent, she's thousands of miles away from all of the other characters, it was very easy to remove her, because removing her story did not impinge directly on any of the other stories. And then I removed a few other characters who, for one reason or another, were also separate from what turned out to be the main action of A Feast for Crows, which was all of the action around King's Landing and the throne ruling the kingdom, the competition for power.
Now, you have this really interesting thing that you do with your writing, which is you have this ability to do these awful things to the characters that we love and the characters that you love. And in fact, this is a wonderful thing. This is what seems to make it so, you know, so compelling. Could you talk a little bit about where that comes from and why you do that?
You know, it's funny because that's gotten a lot of attention in terms of Ice and Fire. But it's not by any means new to Ice and Fire. I've been killing characters my entire career. Maybe I'm just a bloody-minded bastard. I don't know. But if you go back to my first novel, Dying of the Light, which came out in 1977, you can see a very important character in that book dies halfway through, which hopefully was somewhat of a shock to the readers. And, you know, we certainly did it in Wild Cards.
Wild Cards was everybody dying, like...
Not everybody, but certainly many people, and ones you didn't expect. I mean, we killed he was a relatively minor character, but he was a little kid superhero called Kid Dinosaur, who was killed in the third book, and boy, did we get letters about that one. The fans were very, very upset that we killed a little freckle-faced kid. But we were trying to make a point that it was a very realistic book, and, you know, this is not the Marvel or DC universe where people can die or get tremendously beat up and come back the next week. You know, if your arm gets ripped off or something, you're probably going to die and you're not going to come back. And it's a dangerous world to play in.
Well, that also...
Funky 13-year-old kid, you know.
Well, in both those stories, that adds an aspect where I think it makes me care about the characters more because I know they have a definitive mortality and that if they end up, you know... my friend Scott actually cracked me up because when he read the third book, he calls me up in the middle of the night
And he goes, have you read it? And I said, yeah. He said, I put the book in the freezer. I couldn't deal with it. I had to put the book in the freezer. And that was such a, you know, because he had cared so much about the character and he had cared so much about the events that he had to put the book in a freezer to deal with it.
As a writer, my goal, which I'm never going to achieve, I know that, and no writer can achieve it, but my goal is to almost make you live the books. I want you to forget that you're sitting in a chair with a bowl of potato chips by your side reading these pages, turning pages and decoding these symbols of words, black words on white paper. I want you to fall through that page and feel as if these things are happening to you. That's the goal, vicarious experience when you're reading a book. And that includes the full range of emotions, including suspense and fear. Real fear. And, you know, there's a difference. When you go on a roller coaster, you go there for the thrill of being afraid, but you're not really afraid on a roller coaster. I mean, if you talk to someone who's been in a situation where their life was actually in danger, talk to someone who's been in Iraq or in the older days in Vietnam and had someone killed next to them or thought that they were not going to live out the night. Talk to someone who's been mugged at knife point in an urban setting or who has someone break into their house. There's an order of fear there. That's very different from the fear you feel on a roller coaster. And that's the kind of fear I want to engage from my book because I think it's so much stronger. One of them is weak tea, and the other one is you know, strong Irish whiskey here. And I want to serve the strong Irish whiskey. That means when my characters are in danger, I want you to be afraid to turn the next page. I want you to say, you know, goddamn, is Arya going to get out of this situation? You know, and the only way to establish that is to establish very early in the book that sometimes they don't get out of this situation. Sometimes it's too much, and the characters do die, that anyone can die, and the peril is real. And to that mind, you need to show right from the beginning that you're playing for keeps.
Wow. Now, in terms of having been a writer for a long time, can you talk a little bit about some of the lessons you've learned along the way and how your craft has developed?
With the lessons I've learned along the way, nobody knows anything. That's as William Goldman once said in his Adventures in the Skin Trade. That was specifically of Hollywood, but I think it's true of publishing too.
Skin trade or screen trade? It's kind of actually the both.
Yes. You know, there's questions, there's career type questions about that, and there's publishing type questions, or artistic type questions. And as you learn things all the way, you find your own voice. I think when I was beginning as a writer, I had stories I wanted to tell, but I didn't really have my own voice yet. I had certain ways of looking at things, but I did a lot of collaborations. I was always trying new styles. Well, let's try a story in first person, see how that goes. Let's try a story in second person. Boy, that's weird and experimental. Let's see if that goes. You know, you're assembling the tools. You partner up with a young writer who's a friend of yours because they have a different style that you do. You can learn things from them. They can learn things from you. You try different stories. Let me try a horror story. Let me try fantasy. Let me try science fiction, mystery, whatever it is. Let me try to mix and match the two. But at a certain point when you've been in the game long enough, that process sort of comes to an end, and you do sort of develop your own voice. And now you've mastered the tools. You know how to use the hammer. You know how to use the chisel. You know how to use the saw. And it's just a question of making good stuff.
What was the first story that you actually sold?
It was a story called The Hero. Appeared in Galaxy magazine in 1971. I wrote it actually for a creative writing class in college. I was interested in writing even, well, since I was a kid, actually, since I was very young. But it was certainly clarifying as something I might want to pursue as my career. As early as high school, I was publishing little amateur superhero stories in the comic fanzines and of the time, which would be incomprehensible to guys your age. They were produced by high school kids, largely, and sold for a quarter. We called them sticky quarters because you'd take the quarter and you didn't want it bouncing around loose in the envelope when you mailed it to someone. You know, there's no PayPal in those days. So you actually had to mail the guy a physical quarter. So you put it on an index card with a piece of scotch tape so it wouldn't move around, and mailed it through the mail, with a 4-cent stamp in those days. So, and then when he got it, he got a sticky quarter. That was his payment. And they were produced by Ditto often enough, which was this horrible system of reproduction that involved the jelly and pans and things like that, and produced in this kind of faded purple print. But that's what all the comic fanzines were done in, and that's what my earliest stories were published in.
Wow, that's so cool. Now, when you're writing, how much of the story do you see when you begin your very first book? You know, like how far into the entire cycle do you know, and how much of it do you sort of like allow to grow as you go along?
I generally know the broad strokes. I mean, I like to use the analogy of a journey. When I start a book, I know where I'm going. I know the destination of the journey. Like if I'm going from New York to Los Angeles, I know I'm going to wind up in Los Angeles. And I know the principal routes that I'm going to go. Okay, I'm going to go through Chicago. I'm going to go through Denver. I'm going to take this, that, and the other thing. But I certainly don't know what's around every bend. I don't know where I'm going to stop for the night. I don't know what hitchhikers I might pick up, or what interesting roadside attractions I may stop at along the way. So there is a certain sense of adventure that comes out in the writing. And sometimes you do change the destination. Sometimes you get to Chicago and decide to, you know, go south instead of further west, and you wind up taking a different route or going to someplace totally different entirely. That doesn't happen very often, but it does happen once in a while. But that's just me. I mean, there are many different kinds of writers. I like to use the analogy of architects and gardeners. There are some writers who are architects, and they plan everything, they blueprint everything. They know before they drive the first nail into the first board, they know exactly what the house is going to look like and where all the closets are going to be and where the plumbing is going to run. Everything is figured out on the blueprints before they actually begin any work whatsoever. And then there are gardeners who dig a little hole and drop a seed in and, you know, water it with their blood and see what comes up and sort of shake it. They sort of know what seed they've planted. They know whether it's an oak or an elm or a horror story or a science fiction story, but they don't know quite what shape it's going to take or how big it's going to be, etc. I'm much more a gardener than an architect.
Along with that, Don's here! Don! This is Don, another member of Geeks On. Along with that, when you're writing a story, like my grandfather wrote a huge novel, and he had, when at his death, we found that he had had, actually great-grandfather, he had had something like 10,000 pages of backstory, which he had done. How much work do you do behind the scenes in order to keep what you have and that you're going to present to your audience?
Not nearly as much as your crazy grandfather. You know, you do some. You have to do some. But to a certain extent for myself, and I suspect for many contemporary fantasy writers, there's a certain amount of sleight of hand going on. We're working like in the Hollywood tradition, where we have a nice front on the building, but behind it is just boards and it's a false front. It's not real. Our icebergs, three quarters of them aren't below the surface. They're just floating on a board on a raft there. I mean, yes, you get obsessive like Tolkien. I mean, Tolkien is the great example of this. He worked his entire life on Middle-earth. He started writing the Silmarillion when he was in the trenches in World War I and was still writing it when he died in the 70s, and it had to be finished by his son and Guy Gavriel Kay and other people. But Tolkien was not a professional writer, and he was an Oxford don. He was a linguist. His passion was actually the languages, and the stories were almost a secondary byproduct of his obsession with creating a mythology for England and doing that. And of course, he had a career and a salary as an Oxford Don, as a teacher. That was his actual profession. I think for a professional writer like me, I can't afford to take 30 years to work out the languages of Westeros. I have to publish an occasional story if I want to not wind up homeless on the streets. So I can't do that way. I get occasional letters. Like I got a letter a few months ago from someone who wanted to know if I could provide a lexicon of High Valyrian so they could work out some of the structure of how the language worked. And I had to reply, you know, you do seem to have mistaken me for Tolkien. You know, I've invented like 7 words of High Valyrian, and when I need an eighth, I'll invent that. But I'm not going to take out a month to work out an entire fake language of something that even in the book is a dead language.
One of the things that I've noticed about your writing is how wonderfully you create your characters and how great your dialogue is. I mean, it's exquisite. And I wonder if your work in film has informed that, do you think? And care to comment?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, I spent 10 years in Hollywood.
Are you okay?
No.
But
in some ways, Hollywood was good for me. In some ways, it wasn't good for me. I know that was a joke, but you could almost give a serious question to that. Hollywood is a fascinating experience. It's an adventure, but it can devour you, and it's very, very stressful.
Especially writing for a television show.
Yes, but actually, when I look back on my 10 years, I spent the first 5 on television shows. I spent 2 years on Twilight Zone and 3 years on Beauty and the Beast as an actual staff member, you know, producing scripts, and it was very stressful. But the cool thing was about it is, you know, you went through all the hassles, you went through all the grief. You had many weekends that you had to work all weekend. You had nights you would air till 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night, rewriting a script because the scene had to shoot tomorrow. But at the end, they filmed these episodes, and they came out, and millions of people saw and enjoyed them. My second 5 years in Hollywood, I had climbed the Hollywood ladder sufficiently high that I was now in development. I was coming up with ideas for pilot shows of my own. I was writing feature films. That was actually more lucrative than working on a show, because you're higher on the food chain, so you're getting bigger fees because you have all these credits now. But the problem is it is so little gets made. So you work on a project for a year, and then for one reason or another they decide not to do it, and you're on to the next project. Now there are some people out there who are very happy with that. They sit around their kidney-shaped swimming pools and they collect their big checks and they don't care that nothing has ever been made. But I couldn't take it. 5 years of it, I was just crazy. I was spending a year of my life. I'm putting my heart and soul into some of these characters. No one ever sees it except 4 guys in a room. And then someone who's not even in the room decides that, no, it doesn't fit their current profile, what they want to make, you know, or there's a personnel change. Or, you know, there's a million reasons why things don't get made. So at the end, I went back to books. I couldn't take that. But you know, to answer the actual question, Hollywood was very good for me. I think William Goldman in that book that I mistitled before, Adventures in the Screen Trade, which is a terrific book. When I first got my first television job, which was almost an accident, I asked my Hollywood agent at the time, who was an old-timer named Marvin Moss, if there was any good book I could read about television writing and screenwriting, and he said, read that one. And, you know, it's not at all a how-to-write-a-screenplay book. It's really sort of an autobiographical book about Goldman's adventures in Hollywood. But, you know, he does have 2 rules there, and one of them is that nobody knows anything, and the other one is that structure is everything. And I think working in Hollywood definitely improves your structure. You know, you have very tight structures on these things. You have to be an architect to an extent. And I think I was even more of a gardener before Hollywood. And I had to get a little architecture there in my thing to do these outlines that they would be approved so I could go to script and learn how to work up act breaks and things like that. And then the other thing that improves is your dialogue. You know, my early scripts were full of, you know, long people giving long speeches, and they didn't even have to read them. I mean, the directors and the actors would just look at them and see a half-page speech that someone's giving and say, no, this is, they want like two lines back and forth, sharper dialogue. And of course, I learned to do that, and I got better at it as I went on. And you know, it is a better way to write dialogue, I think, than having people give soliloquies like Hamlet all the time. So Hollywood improved my sense of structure and improved my dialogue. And it probably aged me 10 years prematurely. And,
so were any of the stories that you thought up in Hollywood and didn't get to do, did they end up in actual book form?
No, not yet. I occasionally think about that. You know, we're doing this. I'm not sure if your listeners know this, but we're doing this here at the Comic-Con in San Diego. And I've been having meetings all weekend with people who want to do comic projects. And some of those old scripts might actually make pretty good comics. The comic script form and the television movie script form are not that terribly different. So you can make the transition fairly easily, and they're both visual mediums, although, you know, different in significant ways, but still they're both different from books in that you need some kind of colorful image that keeps the eye busy while the ear is listening to the words. But, you know, there's still part of me that would love to get some of those stories out there, either in book form, in comic book form, in television form, in some form, because I did pour, you know, years of my life into some of these stories and characters, and it's a little sad when you go back and say, oh, no one ever got to, I did this cool character and this is a nice thing, and no one ever got to do it except those four guys in that room. And it's sort of sad, but it's difficult too, because sometimes the ownership situation is cloudy. I mean, everything is a collaboration in Hollywood. You're hired by a studio, they give you, you know, six figures to write something. Even though you invent all the characters, each deal is different. So it's not even as clear cut as that. There are things turn around, and you know, what if they give you a one paragraph thing to start? There's a thing called separation of rights. So every situation is different, and sometimes it can be very difficult to disentangle the rights to that.
Speaking on this specific topic, I have a question about wild cards, because I think I would love to see that as a movie or a series.
A series.
And my question for you is, I've heard that, you know, obviously you have a lot of writers that contributed. Has anyone ever approached you about that? And what are some of the pitfalls or reasons that it has not been adapted yet?
Well, Wild Cards has, there's always been interest in Wild Cards for television and film. Going all the way back to, I mean, Wild Cards is a project that's been around for quite a while. We started it in the mid-80s, so it's 20 years old now. And we've published 17 books. There's been a comic series. There's been a role-playing game. And there have been a number of movie options. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, it was under option for 4 years by Touchstone. And Melinda Snodgrass and I collaborated on several drafts of a script for Wild Card. Wild Card is a whole universe. It's like the DC universe. So there are 50 characters. There are 30 different writers involved.
Who do you centralize on?
Yeah, you got to make that call. So Melinda and I, for our script, chose our own two characters, her character, Dr. Tachyon, and my character, the Turtle. And we built our script around that. And we developed it for, it was initially Hollywood Pictures, and then it became Touchstone, both of which are divisions of Disney. And for a while, it looked like it was going to go, but then there were changes, and of course, it didn't go. It wound up getting put out in turnaround, which means we have some rights to it, they have some rights to it. If anybody else wanted to pick up the actual script that Melinda and I wrote, they would have to pay back Disney the money that they invested in that script. That's why it's turnaround, so it makes it a little harder. Now, since that time, there have been several subsequent options. We have the underlying material. The books are free and clear. Anyone in Hollywood can purchase the rights to them. It's just a script that's in turnaround. So, but also it sort of encumbers me and Melinda, because if we were to do a script, if either of us was to do a script, we couldn't really use our old Disney script. And we probably couldn't use those two characters, because Disney would say, look, you're just rewriting what you did for us, so therefore it's turnaround.
Even though you created the original?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not clear-cut. This would be something for a court of law, but you don't want to get into a lawsuit about this. On the other hand, we could sell the Wildcard universe to, say, Universal or Paramount, and they could do a script hiring someone else completely unrelated or even hiring me and Linda, as long as we made this one about Fortunato and the astronomer. Okay, it's clearly it's from the same property, but we're using different characters. There wouldn't be any question of turnaround there. So that's sort of situation. But Wild Cards is coming back, I'm very pleased to say. We've just sold three new books to Tor.
Great.
We'll have volumes 18, 19, and 20 will be out in the next few years, and if they do well enough, we'll have a whole Wild Cards revival.
Will these be multiple writers? Or because I noticed that Melinda wrote a bunch of books herself.
Just one. Yeah, we did 17 volumes of Wild Cards in print to date, 12 from Bantam Books, and two of those 12 were solo novels. Melinda did volume 10, was a solo novel by her, and Vic Milan did volume 12. And then we did three books with Bain, which were all multiple writers. And then there was a seven-year hiatus, and then iBooks brought us back, and one of those was a solo novel by John J. Miller. That was the last one out, volume 17, Death Draws 5, which came out about 2 weeks before iBooks went bankrupt. So if you haven't gotten that one, pick it up very soon now, because it's going to be the rarest Wild Card book, and I expect the value of it is going to start skyrocketing, because when the company goes bankrupt the week after publishing your book, it's not a good thing. But Tor has stepped in, and the new series is going to be all new characters. I mean, unlike like the Marvel and DC characters that are going on down below here at this convention, our characters are very much tied to real time and real history. So it dawned on us we had a lot of 60-year-old superheroes kicking around in the Wild Card books. They were getting a little gray and paunchy. So we said, let's you know, those characters are still there, the ones who didn't die horribly, but let's explore the next generation, the 19 to 20-year-old kids have grown up in the Wild Card universe.
Or Croyd, who's...
Well, Croyd is a constant, yeah. Croyd will always be kicking around. And there are a few others. Golden Boy, who never seems to age, is always perpetually 23. He'll probably still be kicking around.
Fantastic. Also, with I had a question about this as well, Pete, which was specifically for Tough Voyaging, which I thought was such a fantastic book. It so deserved to be made into a movie. And is there anything going on with that? Is it a possibility? I mean, anything's a possibility, but...
Well, if someone wants to give me a wheelbarrow full of money, I'll sell them the rights. But there has actually never been any interest in Tough Voyaging.
Really?
Unlike Wild Cards, which has a history of being optioned and so forth. And some of my other things have been optioned. Fever Dream has been optioned. Armageddon Rag has been optioned. But there's never been any interest in Tough Voyaging.
It was so cinematic to me and so simplistic, just in terms of the three. I mean, because it's got three acts. It's like bang, bang, bang. We're going to tell the story of this. And it was basically the corruption of one man. And really watching his corruptive story was so, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it was such a neat story. I was like, this is so simplistically turned into a movie. Why is no one doing it?
I don't know the studios want to do stories about corruption of one man. They want hero franchises where people are redeemed. Also, Tough is a very idiosyncratic character. And certainly 20 years ago when the book came out, I don't think that would have flown. They wanted parts that could be played by Mel Gibson and Tom Cruise, not a really fat, totally hairless man who speaks in very strange, stilted sentences. I've always visualized Tough as sort of a buffer Alfred Hitchcock.
I thought he would be perfectly played by Michael Chiklis. Or is it Michael Chiklis? Chiklis. From The Shield. I mean, he'd just be it.
Chiklis is bald, or can be bald, so that might work. I don't know. Chiklis is sort of tougher, has more of an edge. Tough is sort of soft. I mean, that's part of... You think he's a pushover, and he turns out not to be. You know, he's always got his cats, and, there's a little Nero Wolf kind of stuff going on there. But actually, the present climate might be better for it. I mean, we now have heroes on television like Monk, for example, who's completely loony. And so this deeply flawed protagonist who doesn't necessarily look like a matinee idol is actually probably more common today than it was 20 years ago.
Brilliant. Now, I was lucky enough to be at your reading yesterday where you read the first chapter of A Dance with Dragons. And
you heard of Dance with Dragons?
I did. You guys hate me already.
You understand, we're going to take him out back and beat him up.
and it made me start to think. I was noticing, sort of your theme of ice and fire and how it's running through your novel. And I'm wondering, to what extent do you think about theme before you write, and to what extent does it just sort of evolve as you go along?
Oh, more evolution, I think.
I have to share one quick story with you. I've shared the Song of Fire and Ice with everyone, and everyone's been addicted to it. And for some reason, I'm spreading the gospel, sir. You believe me. But for some reason, every single person gets to the same point in one of the books, where the Feast of Blood, and they all read that portion of the book at 3 a.m., every single one of them, for some reason. And every single one of them calls me up the next day at 8 a.m. sharp, saying, "You have no idea how much I hate you right now. How did you get me to read this series? And God bless you," right? So I guess my question is, if I can get that much hatred just from sharing your books, the sheer love that these people have for the characters, the attachments they form, I know I've received an interesting amount of attention from people I've shared the books with. As the father of the series, I've understood that you've had some aggressive fans pursuing you for the next novel. I understand Amazon.com declared a release date long before it was ready.
Release dates. It drives me crazy. I don't know where they get them. They even have page counts. You know, they'll say, yes, it'll be out on September 12th, and it'll be 709 pages. And I'm still writing the thing, so I have no idea how I know it'll be 709 pages. And then when it doesn't come out on that date, when Amazon moves it back, then I get a flood of emails. Why is it being delayed? What's the story? Because Amazon doesn't put out a story. They just change the date suddenly, or they put publisher delayed. They're working on things from publishers, but I've begged my publisher, please don't announce any release date until the book is done and I turn it in. Because if you keep announcing the date, I mean, what happened? The last book was very late. There's no doubt about that. You know, Feast for Crows, the book that I was talking earlier, I divided in two. It should have been in. It took me 5 years between books. I'm supposed to take 2 years. So I was 3 years late with the book. And it was repeatedly delayed and delayed and delayed. And every delay got me tons of email. And I kept begging my publisher, stop putting it on the schedule. Just wait until it's done and then put it on the schedule. Because if you keep putting it on the schedule based on my projections and then I don't meet the projection, then I get another delay and I got more disappointed fans and so forth.
Speaking on behalf of just a bunch of friends that I know who've read the books, we would much prefer that you put out the quality product that you have put out than
I just want to show you this comic. I think you might find it slightly amusing.
It's a comic of a, it looks like Kevin Smith sort of character. So I've got a lot of play.
Yes.
That's exactly the story.
We'll link to that.
We'll link to the comments. So now, what are you actually here at Comic-Con promoting?
Well, I'm the series, actually, Bantam Books, my main publisher, has a booth down in the big room, and publishers are more and more coming to San Diego Comic-Con. Del Rey's been doing it for a few years. They're sister publisher of Bantam. Bantam came for the first time last year, and this is their second time there, and they wanted to promote Ice and Fire. So we were here yesterday. We were giving away free copies of Game of Thrones to anyone who wanted one. You know, the first one is free. It's like a crack.
It is like crack.
Yeah. But of course, I have a lot of other stuff going on. I have a Fever Dream comic coming out from Avatar Press. They have a little preview that they're giving. Well, not they're giving away. They're selling it for 99 cents at their booth. A little six-page preview of the Fever Dream comic adaption. And I've been having meetings with various other comic publishers about various other projects.
How did the Hedge Knight, which was a comic, come into being?
It started with these kids called the Dabble Brothers, four young kids. Well, I say kids. They're kids to me. Some of them are in their early 20s. Some of them are in their teens. Four brothers, Ernst, Les, Pascal, and David. They contacted me and wanted to do an Ice and Fire comic. And I said, no, I'm not. You've never published a comic. Yeah, you want to start a comic company, but I don't know how you'll do, you know. Nah, you know. And then Les was the one I was mainly hearing from, and he wouldn't take no for an answer. Then he sent me some conceptual art, and I said, no, this is all wrong, and, you know, I don't like this kind of comic art. Look at this guy. His muscles are bigger than his head, and, you know, et cetera. And then he came back again with a different artist and said, how about, well, yeah, that's actually pretty good. Yeah, you're getting it now, you know, but I still wouldn't give him Ice and Fire because it's too big. I don't know how you do this comic, but Les was so persistent, I finally said, well, I'll tell you what, I wrote this prequel to Ice and Fire called The Hedge Knight. It takes place in the same world, but about 100 years earlier. I'll give you that, and we'll see how you do with that, and, you know, if you do a good job, we can talk about other stuff later. So they took it and ran with it, and they published a wonderful comic book. They got Mike S. Miller to do the art. A guy named Ben Avery did the adaption, which was very, very faithful to my my book. And they published this terrific six-issue comic series, which is now a graphic novel. And we're getting geared up to do the second one, The Sworn Sword, which is the sequel to The Hedge Knight.
Is there going to be any connection between those comics and the actual series of The Song of Ice and Fire?
What kind of connection? I'm not sure.
Other than just the worlds, is actually the main character within the first one ever going to take part within or his lineage?
He's dead. He's
no. I mean his lineage because he is becoming a hedge knight.
There are references to yeah.
Okay. Cool. Don, do you have one?
Strange question for you, but do you have any favorite sentences that you've ever seen, read, written?
Favorite sentences.
Absolutely okay.
You know, there are certainly sentences by other writers that linger in one's memory, and I suppose you'd call them favorite sentences. In my own work, I don't know. There are certain sentences. I take a lot of care, usually for like the closing sentences of books or chapters, but more particularly books or stories. The final sentence, the opening sentences, those take a lot of care. In a big work like Ice and Fire, sometimes the chapter endings.
Yeah, the chapter endings on Ice and Fire are fantastic. They always end on an up. I've actually had a really interesting experience with that, is that my girlfriend, when we go on trips and stuff like that, I've read her the first three books of the series so far, and we're on to the fourth book out loud. And so The Song of Ice and Fire really has become a song to me because, you know, I've sort of kept all the characters and what they sound like in my head, and I'm an actor, so I've acted out each individual character for her.
Poor damn soul.
And I've read it to her unabridged, so it's
with him on the train. It's like riding with Sybil.
So it's really interesting for me just how you've structured those chapters so that they do always they always end up on this really interesting.
As the Hollywood influence, it's learning to do act breaks when you're working in television, of course, and act breaks will sometimes kill you when you. What do you mean? I have to have some kind of false cliffhanger here or some moment so we can go to commercial and sell cleaning products. It's a crazy artificial construct, but ultimately, after you get through your first fit of artistic pique about being forced to do that, you realize it's really not that bad. I mean, it's accepting a structure like the sonnet or the haiku. You know, they have a certain structure, and if you want to write that, you work within that structure. And it's a question of are you flexible and skilled enough as a writer to work with different structures? The novel, teleplay, the movie, they all have their own demands.
Wow. When you get inside your character's heads, and especially when you get inside characters' heads of characters that are different than you are, very different, what is your process of doing that, of finding their voice, of making them real, you know, when they're so unlike you?
That's difficult, but you know, basically, I think we're all human beings, and I suppose it's empathy that comes down to it. You know, it's an imaginative leap that you have to make, but I think it's what distinguishes the best writers from ones that are not perhaps so good. I mean, there are a lot of good writers out there. I don't want to say they're not good, but who write about characters who are essentially very much like them, even if that character lives in the far future or the distant past or in an alternate dimension or something. They sort of talk like the writer. They sort of have the background of the writer. If the writer's male, they're male. They're of an age with the writer, especially when some of these series began. And they reflect the writer's political and philosophical views. It's easy to do that, of course. That's the simplest thing. It's harder, I think, when you're writing about someone who's not like you. And the more unlike you that person becomes, the more difficult it becomes. Some writers can't make that jump. And I think in particularly in those writers, you definitely see black and white, good and evil. You know, those writers tend to see the world in very simplistic ways, because their attitudes are good and people who oppose them are evil. And you know, you get this kind of black and white thing. Well, I paint in shades of gray, and maybe it's even as a kid I was always thinking, what it would be like to be somebody else. How does this feel to this other person? And making that kind of empathic leap. Of course, you're never going to get things right. If I'm writing from a viewpoint of a 12-year-old girl, I've never been a 12-year-old girl. I have been 12 years old, though. I think a 12-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl have some similar experiences. They also have some different experiences, and for that you need to read things written by 12-year-old girls, or you need to talk to the women in your life and say, what was it like when you were 12 years old, and you know, this happened to you, or how would you feel about this? And you have to do that, but ultimately you have to draw in yourself. I mean, the only person we ever really know is ourself. We can base our characters on friends and relatives. We can base them on figures from history. We can base them on people we've read autobiographies of, or biographies or memoirs or whatever, which gives some insight into how people thought in other times and other places. But really, down deep, the only person we ever really have a complete understanding of is ourself. So we have to reach down, and there are parts of me in all the characters, whether we're talking about someone like the great and powerful Turtle in Wild Cards, who is probably the closest to me autobiographically. I mean, he comes from my hometown. He lives in the apartment that I lived in as a kid. He has much of my background. We both had turtles as pets. I just didn't happen to develop any superpowers. Or characters who live in distant worlds and are very, very different, like, and you know, our girls or are horribly scarred or are dwarfs. So, you know, I've never had any of those experiences, but it's empathy that hopefully tries to make them come alive, and an understanding that there are certain things that I think are fundamental to all human beings. You know.
That's great. Now, just a few things in closing. What three books would you recommend to our readers, the most that they should read?
Beyond my own, of course. Well, if they're science fiction fantasy readers, Lord of Light by Roger Zelazny. Probably his greatest book. Something by Jack Vance, who's my favorite living science fiction fantasy writer. Maybe The Dying Earth, which was a very a short story collection, but very seminal in the genre. A lot of subsequent fantasy came out of The Dying Earth. Or the Demon Prince series of five science fiction novels. That's a terrific one, too, by Vance. Beyond that, I don't know, maybe Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. That's another terrific book. But, of course, if you ask me that question tomorrow, I give you three different books. So there are really 30 or 40 books that they should read.
I just wanted to thank you for
giving us your time and, you know, your thoughtfulness. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
He's amazing. He's
just lovely. That man.
I guess I should read the Game of Thrones.
You really should. You really.
Does anybody? Yeah, I guess one of you have it.
Of course, I have it.
Oh yeah, we have it.
All right. Can I borrow?
My copy's falling apart. I've read it so many times.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've read it 5 times. You can have mine.
5 times? Yeah. Yes. Come on. Let me borrow.
Yeah.
Okay. I've read it five times.
Wow. I thought I was a fanboy.
No.
But before we leave, we want to direct people to our website, www.geekson.com, where we have...
Tell them about the contest.
Yes, we've got a contest. We're going to announce our first contest here, but we have archive episodes of all the geek topics that we've talked about in the last year and change.
We have great forums.
We've got great forums with all sorts of great discussions about everything geeky and geek news.
Tell them about the contest.
And this week, because we have a George R.R. Martin episode, we're going to give away a copy of a George R.R. Martin board game.
Game of Thrones.
The Game of Thrones board game. A new, brand new spanking copy. All you need to do to enter is to go to our website, www.geekson.com, go into our forums, register, get a name on there, and post your
thoughts
opinions.
About the George R. R. Martin episode.
Yep, there'll be an episode link for this specific episode. Just go there, find it, post what you think about the episode, the interview, about his books, and anything else that we talked about this episode. You need at least just one post. Multiple posts don't get you more entries, but you can post all you would like. And then we will, and I think 2 episodes from now.
Not next one, but
not
the one
next
afterward.
Episode. We have to leave a little time for people to get there.
Right.
We will reach into our magical bag of holding.
And randomly, what was the Dungeons and Dragons bag of mini tricks? Bag of mini tricks. That's the one we had the random card you pulled out.
Oh, yeah, that's the bag of mini tricks.
Bag of mini tricks. We'll pull out one of the names, and somebody will win
the Game of Thrones board game.
Dun, dun, dun.
Sound good?
We told you about the contest.
Excellent. All right. So unless anybody has anything else to say.
Nope.
It's a long episode.
I think Mr. Martin said it all.
Yes, have a good week, geek week, everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
See you next week.
Geek it out.
Rock it out.